Now on Bloomberg 106.1.
Among the most difficult jobs in the public sector in Massachusetts, at least, is running the MBTA. No question about it.
What I don't want to see is people being laid off. I want to see continue seeing people go back to work.
I'm very worried that the Fed is going to tip this economy into recession.
Are you suggesting that we abolish the MBTA?
I think that's probably where we need to start. Heads have got to roll.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Joe Shortsleeve, and Kim Kerrigan on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 92.9 HD2.
Well, good afternoon on this beautiful day. I was just outside looking at the Christmas tree up there at Macy's.
We were all here working.
You were hoping that I wouldn't return, right? Yeah. Well, Joe, some of us get our work done quicker than others. I can't help that. I'm Tom Maroney. He's Joe Shortsleeve. Kim Kerrigan is here. We're in the house. Janet Wu and Mastu. I don't need to go on. Tech is leading stocks lower in this hour. We're going to have a full report from Mr. Charlie Pellett. And good afternoon to everyone out there. My tea and biscuits are by my side, or they shall be shortly. A bit of a British flair to the program today. As we ready for the Royals. Joe, I know you're excited.
Is that what that was?
Yeah. Kate and William are arriving tomorrow. There you go.
That was actually good.
Tomorrow.
That was good.
That's pretty good. And Master's going to be there in City Hall to cover all the action. Meanwhile, at 2:15 today, that's just a few minutes from now, we're going to speak to the British Consul General. He's Peter Abbott. He's been on this program. He's a genial chap. And as you can imagine, he'll be in close attendance with this couple as they make their rounds and hand out a prestigious climate change award of $1.1 million to a group of innovators here in Boston. Boston was picked as the first city outside the UK to host this event. So there you go. We even hear that President Biden may be there. Kim, you were the one to tell me that. These unconfirmed reports? I think they still are unconfirmed
that he's going to go. Okay. But he will certainly be here in the city.
Well, certainly is a coincidence.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, you know,
he's attending a fundraiser. Yeah.
Maybe we should go out there and see if he's walking down the street, pull him in for an interview. We did ask for the Royals. They are not granting any media interviews.
Okay, so a couple of things. The first thing is the World Cup is going on right now.
Oh.
The U.S. is playing Iran. It's just getting started here at 2 o'clock straight up. This is a do-or-die situation for the U.S. Mm-hmm. So I will keep everybody updated on that as we move through the next couple of hours. But it's just getting started at 2 o'clock.
Oh.
Secondly, this is Giving Tuesday.
Oh.
Yes, it is.
So let's talk a little bit about that. This is a worldwide event. It started 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. The idea is pretty simple. Make giving a big part of your everyday life. So the idea is it's rooted in generosity. Mm. It's also rooted in uplifting communities. So people are asked to give to their favorite charities today if they can. And if you can't, then you're asked to do things like give blood, give of your time, whatever the case may be.
What about just being nice just to each other?
Well, I think that's okay too, to be perfectly
that's me
honest.
Every day. So.
Anytime.
There you go. So
anytime.
let me tell you that last year on Giving Tuesday, 35 million Americans participated and they donated $2.7 billion last year.
Yeah.
That was a 9% increase over 2020.
All right.
So people are hoping for an even bigger turnout today.
Well, let's continue that conversation. You know, obviously it follows Black Friday and Cyber Monday, which is, you know, the for-profit side of things. And on the nonprofit side, we wanted to bring in Maura Sullivan. She is the Arc of Massachusetts Senior Director for Governmental Affairs and Health Policy. And, of course, the ARC lobbies on behalf of the some 200,000 people with disabilities here in the state of Massachusetts. Maura, thank you very much for joining us. Talk to us about Giving Tuesday and how important it is to an organization like the ARC.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for having me. And, yeah, happy Giving Tuesday. It's an incredibly important day. It's the time of year where people start thinking about donating to support the important causes that are close to their heart. And for us, most of our, I'd say over 50% of our gifts from individual donors are received between Giving Tuesday and the end of the year. So we really want to start the giving season strong. So thanks for having me.
So, Maura, Tom Maroney here, Maura Sullivan with the ARC of Massachusetts. You're the Legal Affairs Legislative Liaison Director, correct?
Yep, government affairs.
That's government affairs. Well, this is very personal for me. My youngest son is in a group home, and I can tell you this is noble work these people do. But I also have to say, and for people who don't know, and certainly you do, Maura, the staffing levels, the resources are just, you know, I don't know how they do it and how they make do with what they have. So maybe you can echo that and tell us where we can, if we decide we're going to be generous to the ARC, how we can do that.
Oh, absolutely, Tom. And I'm with you 100% personal. I have a young son in a group home as well, and another son with autism. Mm. So living it also. And yes, it's the workforce shortage crisis that is our biggest challenge right now. And, you know, that layered upon the pandemic was just horrible timing for our community. We have been advocating to increase the rate for the workforce, so that more people will come and be workers in the field and actually take jobs in our day programs and our group homes. But right now, we're really feeling the pinch.
Maura, give us a quick idea. What's the rate? What's the rate of pay? Because I was shocked when I heard some of these numbers.
Yeah. So we've been advocating for the last year to bring it up from $16.80 to closer to $20 an hour. So we were really happy to see in the economic development bill that we got about $225 million for human services workforce, and that should bump that rate up a little bit, probably closer to 18, 19, we're hoping, and add some funds for retention bonuses and recruiting people on with bonuses. That was really good news, and we are hoping it will make an impact.
Maura, this is Kim Kerrigan. Let me ask you about giving today. How do people go about giving to the ARC today, and can it be designated specifically for one area or another?
Sure. Yeah, you will find on our website, all you have to do is arcofmass.org, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And we have giving packages, so you can see like what amount of money would make an impact on a certain program. Our advocacy is kind of our number one push, and specifically for funding for these programs and for workforce. But we also have training for medical students and other really great initiatives. So you can take a look at our website or any of our social media.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Maura Sullivan, she's the ARC of Massachusetts, a Senior Director of Government Affairs and Health Policy on this Giving Tuesday. Maura, I know that some of the legislation that the ARC is hoping for has to do with a program called Operation House Call. Perhaps you could tell us what that is and where is that legislation?
Sure. Yeah, this is my program. We train medical students in best practices when treating patients with autism and IDD, and that's intellectual or developmental disabilities. And we think families and individuals have a lot to teach doctors. So that's been the premise of our program. It's been operating at the ARC for about 10 years. And we are able to actually be in every medical school and a couple of nursing schools, but the program definitely needs funding to stay afloat. And we also have the legislation. We'd love to see it codified into law here in Massachusetts, that all medical students and nursing students and dental students should have some training in how to treat patients with autism and intellectual or developmental disabilities. So we have that one hanging on during the informal session right now, hoping that we can pass that through.
Yeah, and I know that, you know, again, from personal experience, how few and far between there are medical professionals who have that sort of background. It doesn't take a whole lot to get them going, and I know people are eager to learn. Maura, if you could, how important is Giving Tuesday to, you know, your operating budget, for instance? Is there any percentage you can give us? Do you get 10% on a day like this? Is it more or less? Give us some idea.
Yeah, so I think it's a huge, important time of year, but specifically kicking it off today, we're hoping to bring in $10,000. That would be a great amount for us to get on a day like today, and then to continue to build on that through the end of the year, bringing in at least 50% of our donations that way.
Yeah.
So it is critical, and we do hope people, there's a lot of competition. There's many nonprofits and some, you know, wonderful organizations, but the ARC can really use some help now.
And Maura, one final thing now. I want to make sure I understood. So you bring in 50% of your giving between now and the end of the year. I mean, people can give at any point, correct?
Exactly. Yeah. This is a good time of year for individual donors.
Okay.
They can, they're ready to do that and write off their taxes. And it's really a time of year where people feel like they really want to give. So yeah. It's a great time for us to reach out. And also, we put together some great packages so you can really donate to something that you know will make a difference.
Well, without further ado, let's get into this. I mean, this is an exciting week here in Boston. I mean, I can't tell you how excited I am. We have two royals coming. I mean, this is top shelf royalty. This isn't, you know, the Duchess of someplace you never heard of before. This is Kate and William. They're showing up, and on Friday they're awarding $1.1 million to a group of innovators in climate change. Boston was chosen as the first city outside the UK to host this event. This is a very prestigious award. And before that, they're going to be making the rounds, and I'm sure they're going to be guided by this gentleman, Peter Abbott, OBE, by the way. He is the Consul General here for the British Empire in Boston. He has been that since 2020. I have to say, Peter, you've been everywhere, West Africa, Lisbon, and you interned for Denny Hastert when he was Speaker of the House, and you have a PhD in Greek tragedy. Why don't we have you on more often?
Tom, with introductions like that, I will have to be on more often, I think. Thank you.
What's your role in all this? Are you going to be on the arm of Kate as you walk them around Boston?
So part of the role of a diplomatic mission like ours, ahead of a big event like this one, is to put in place lots of the building blocks for the program for the visitors. So we've been working for months, working with the Earthshot Prize, which you talked about already, and also working with the John F. Kennedy Library Foundation, who are one of the principal partners of the Earthshot Prize here in Boston.
So will you be with them as they make these stops, Peter?
I will, yep. And really, really looking forward to showing them a little bit of this amazing city.
Yeah. Now, what do you know about President Biden? All of a sudden, his schedule has him in Boston at the same time. What can you tell us? Give.
I can't tell you anything, Tom. I think the White House press spokesman said something about this the other day, but... I can't comment, I'm afraid.
Peter Abbott is with us. He's the British Consul General right here in Boston. We're talking about the big visit from Kate and William, the Prince of Wales and the Princess of Wales. Peter, give us I know Friday's the big day for this award, and it's a very prestigious climate change award. What are the other highlights of their couple of days here?
Well, they start off alongside Mayor Michelle Wu at City Hall tomorrow, where they will be lighting up a number of buildings across Boston green to launch the Earthshot Prize. They're going to be spending some time at Greentown Labs out in Somerville, which is North America's largest climate tech incubator, and that ties in with the innovation and creativity theme that the Earthshot Prize really, really celebrates. They're going to be visiting an organization called ROCA, which works with at-risk young people. That's out in Chelsea. And that gives their Royal Highnesses a chance to draw on some of their expertise in mental health, homelessness, and addiction, some of the work they've done on those issues.
Wonderful.
In the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Peter, what does a visit like this do for the business relationship between our two countries?
Well, I think, as I've mentioned, the Earthshot Prize really focuses on innovation and creativity. And I think, you know, you've seen a number of the 15 finalists this year. Our companies, they're small startups, they're sort of larger companies, they're innovators. So I think it really sends a message that, you know, the big companies, the well-established blue chip companies are really important. But I think it's also the smaller, really innovative, really nimble companies in the UK and the US and around the world that are going to be scaling up and helping to tackle the climate crisis that we find ourselves in.
Well, it's just wonderful. I was telling our audience that this is the first time outside the UK. $1.1 million, this is to be shared among folks, recipients, or goes to one group?
No, it is £1 million, $1.1 million to each of the five finalists every year. It's not just the money, though. It's also the access they get to a global network of the professional and technical support to help these companies, these organizations scale up their products. So it's really significant.
I want to spend a few minutes on the home building industry now. Obviously, there's been some big changes with interest rates and with inflation, a lot of headwinds there. Our guest is Jeff Brehm. Now, Jeff is the new president of the Home Builders and Remodelers Association of Massachusetts. Mr. Brehm is president of Meisner Brehm. This is a civil engineering and land surveying firm in Westford and Salem, New Hampshire. Jeff also owns Westford-based home builder Quality Green Homes. Jeff, welcome. It's good to have you with us. We always curious about what's going on. I was thinking, how do we start this conversation? You've been at this for 30 years, I'm told. I mean, if I had a day to just drive around the Commonwealth, let's keep it simple, Greater Boston, what kind of building activity would I see as compared to 2 or 3 years ago? Is it quiet? Is it busy? I mean, you tell us.
Good afternoon, Tom and Joe and whoever else is there. Jeff Brehm, hello, everyone.
Yeah,
you drive around, you're going to see construction. The COVID hasn't hit us that bad. Thankfully, there was still the move out to the suburbs from the city. The city's still being built, as you know, as you've been just talking about with Mr. Cronin. Mm. You'll see construction. We have a lot of issues, though, which I'm sure we're going to get into in the next 20 or 30 minutes. But the building business is doing well, but we're starting to begin to struggle right now. We're probably the first group that's been hit by the recession, if you will. So.
Yeah, Jeff, Joe Shortsleeve here. Our Bloomberg real estate reporter Prashant Gopal was on this program yesterday. His headline on the Bloomberg Terminal: U.S. housing enters deep freeze, with sellers and buyers sidelined. How accurate is that headline?
It's fairly accurate. We have a national economist, Professor Dietz, and he came to the Northeast region a little while ago, and he already predicted when we were all considering whether we were in a recession or not. He said, from housing's point of view, we're in a recession.
Mm.
Thankfully, during COVID, we had buyers coming out here, but there's no question we're in a recession. And we have more than just interest rates, which are obviously slowing down the buy end. We have inflation, as you just mentioned, costing us as well as everybody more money for materials. Labor problems are enormous. They've been a problem in our industry for decades, but especially the last 10 years, where we have a workforce problem. Who wants to go into the trades? There's so much work out there. Why would you want to freeze and hang on a beam all winter long when you could, work at home and call in? So we've had a workforce issue. We have had the same supply chain issues that every industry's had.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had to deal with COVID. And COVID, although we popped through it pretty well, we still had to make the changes and deal with the problems, just like every other industry did.
Jeff, where's the good news?
Jeff, all due respect, a few minutes ago you said everything's fine.
Come on.
There is some good news.
Come on, let's hear it.
Thankfully, lumber prices have gotten normalized.
I was going
to
mention
that. They were up to 1,600 board feet just a couple, 18 months ago or so. They've come way down.
Yeah.
We do have buyers out there. If you are building the right product, right now anyway, there are buyers. Certainly,
well, what's the right product? Trading.
Well, the right product is really the right price. The right product at the right price, what people want.
Single-family home we're talking about.
Single-family home. But for example, what I'm doing is I've built the last two houses I built. They had two separate offices in each house. So, or remote working.
Oh, you're finding that. I bet you're finding more and more of that, right?
Absolutely. I mean, not just one office, but two enclosed offices, sometimes in basements built out so that people can work at home. That you have to meet the market. So those are some of the things that the market wants.
Well, on the remodelers side of your title, Northeast Home Builders and Remodelers, so most people, when they remodel, they go out and get themselves a home equity loan. And given what's going on with interest rates these days, I would suspect that's not as desirable a product for people working on their homes.
Absolutely. But there's been kind of a backlog of work in the remodeling industry. Most of the remodelers I know are flat out. So thankfully, these people have money somehow. That's a whole different discussion where the economics of homeowners and where their money comes from. But the remodelers are busy. My sister's remodeling, or I'm remodeling. The people I know are remodeling. And my fellow builders are all straight out. So
what's the trick to find? What's the trick to finding a good remodeler? I mean, obviously, do we go to your website? Do we go to your association? How do we know who to hire?
Absolutely. Well, we our association is for advocacy for the building industry, and generally we have members that are, you know, committed to building. So we have people that are it's their, not just their fun vocation or something they do on the side. It is their vocation. And so I definitely think you should check, a home buyer should check, not just are they a home improvement contractor, an HIC, not only do they have their proper licenses, construction supervisor's license, but I would recommend that they be a member of the Home Builders Association and be part of the groups and associations that are part of the industry. That shows a commitment to their basically vocation.
So
check your references. Follow, for obviously, anybody that would hire a subcontractor needs to understand the process, understand the contractual end of things as well as the construction end of things.
Jeff Brehm is with us. He's the fairly new president of the Home Builders and Remodelers Association of Massachusetts. Jeff, all right, so remodelers are busy. You're remodeling. Other people are remodeling. Let's go to the dark side here. I mean, obviously this isn't apples to apples, but I spent a lot of time reporting on the lobster industry, and these guys, when things got bad, they went and did other things. I mean, what are, you know, I don't know how many people you have working for you at a given time, but you must know people that have said, look, I'm going to hang it up here and I got to go find something else to do. I mean, we're certainly at that point in some regard, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely. So let me back up. I'm sort of an optimist, and I have a friendly way about myself. So, yeah. But I, myself personally, I've got a project in Groton, Massachusetts, about 30 miles northwest of Boston, and it was going to be a bigger project, and I'm slowing it way down. I'm only building 2 units in that project right now. And
why is that? You can't get the help?
I'm worried about all these things that we just talked about. Mm. I'm worried about what I don't really know my cost of construction. Mm. I don't know when I could deliver it because of the supply chain issues. I've got a huge problem with trying to do this as an all-electric unit. I can't get the materials for the all-electric house, so we're changing the way we're designing the HVAC system. It's kind of waiting right now for the HVAC system. Other materials I've got, I mean, you've all heard stories of supply chain issues. I waited 16 weeks for a window in my own house. So
you're the president of this group. Don't you have any clout?
You think so? I pull where I can.
Yeah.
It's all about the, you know, international trade issues.
No.
That I hear stories of chip problems, but you know what is a window? The problems there have to do with the materials of getting the windows built.
Mm-hmm.
I have a builder in Concord. He's got 3 houses that are framed and waiting for 6 months for windows. You know, specialty windows, but He's waiting for those windows, and I asked him this a couple of weeks ago, why are the houses unstalled? Why are they stalled up? And he said, I'm just waiting for product. So
yeah, but as the economy slows down, are prices coming down?
Our prices to build are definitely not, so that's not coming down. Will prices eventually come down? It's hard. The problem on our end is it's only so much margin. And you ask the question, why am I slowing down? Because I don't know what my margin is. If my costs going in are unknown and my sale is unknown, I've talked to different realtors. What am I going to get for the house when it's done? And I'm getting all kinds of numbers. The good news is they say that I'm going to get what I need, but that's today. It won't be delivered till April. Right. And well, am I going to get that in April? I don't know. So I'm nervous, and most builders are nervous right now.
Yeah.
We have a thing called a builder sentiment. And it's gone way down.
Yeah, I can imagine.
As we've been reporting throughout the pandemic, the city of Boston is making efforts to fill vacant storefronts and bring people back downtown, especially to the crown jewel of Faneuil Hall and Quincy Market. Now, just a few blocks away on Hanover Street in the North End is the Improv Asylum, which is an improvisational comedy theater with regular shows and classes. Yeah, but get this. It's also a big multi-million-dollar business in both Boston and New York City. So big that it's taken over more than 4,000 square feet at Faneuil Hall Marketplace. It's become a co-working space for creatives, as they are known. Bloomberg's Ann Muster was now right here in our Boston studio to explain. Ann.
Yeah, Tom and Joe, this is a really interesting business story and sort of an architecture story. The brains behind this is Norm Lavalette, co-founder and CEO of Improv Asylum, who needed more office space and simply started walking around Boston. His vision was actually to start a co-working space for creatives, anyone who needs space to rehearse, audition, perform, or record, the kind of space and equipment that are really not available at places like WeWork. He noticed a large empty retail space by Faneuil Hall near chain stores like The Gap and Banana Republic, and contacted the property owner, New York-based Gazette Horizons, which is a division of Israeli property investment firm Gazette Globe. They may have been skeptical, but they needed a tenant.
This used to be an American Eagle.
It says fitting rooms. You kept the fitting rooms.
We kept the fitting rooms. And as I say, we're about 90% there in terms of what we want to do. We turned this fitting room into a podcast studio. So this is a podcast studio. And then that's what we'll look at for, you know, these other fitting rooms. We're getting a lot of interest in individual recording studios. In the music industry, the folks that we work for the music industry, what we're hearing is there's not a ton of high-quality, affordable music studio space.
Just outside these fitting rooms turned recording studios is the main retail space, which Lavalette has divided into glass offices, dance and rehearsal rooms, and a main stage, complete with a microphone. There's plenty of seating everywhere. Like any good co-working space, there are, of course, snacks, soft drinks, and beer.
The Asylum Co-Lab, this basically functions as both the corporate offices for Improv Asylum and our comedy companies. This here is where our full-time staff works. And again, it's very much of a hybrid model. They come in, as they say, fit, 3 or 4 days a week. But it's really up to them. And we run Improv Asylum. We run Laugh Boston. We run Asylum NYC. You know, most of our businesses we run out of this office.
How many employees do you have?
All told, across all of our companies, we probably have 100-plus employees. From a full-time standpoint, it's probably about 12. But then when you add everybody else in terms of actors and staff and stuff like that, it's probably over 100 at this point. So much of this is designed around Improv Asylum's training center. When the students come in, it's classroom and rehearsal space. We have over, I think, something like 380 students enrolled right now. So, I mean, it's pretty robust. But the other part about it is there are so many professional creative artists, be it independent instructors, dancers, vocal teachers. And one of the things that we've always struggled with is, well, how do you have really good space that meet the needs of the creative artists? Because I know that you have your WeWorks and you have all your other co-working spaces, but they're not physically or psychologically designed for the artist.
Yeah, you could do a lot of different things in this room. You've got seating, you've got a large rug, so there's actually a nice sound quality to this room.
Absolutely.
And you could have performance or...
It can be theatrical, it can be vocal, it can be dance. We do a lot with dance. People come hang out, right? But it's also a wonderful window onto Faneuil Hall, so we would just want to make sure that it looks cool. And again, it gives artists a place to work in a real and meaningful way.
How many tenants do you have for the co-working space?
Right now we have one full-time tenant. They're actually here right now. That's Paradise Casting, and that's our long-term tenant. And then everybody else just kind of comes in as an on-need basis. So Urbanity Dance Company has come in. People kind of come and go, various improv groups, theatrical groups. We just hosted a larger storytelling group, but all centered around teachers. We're just shifting into our own marketing mode because it was originally created just for our own needs.
Yeah. And where were your offices before now?
Our offices were located, so our theater, Improv Asylum, is at 216 Hanover Street, which is in the North End. And our offices were directly across the street. They're on the third floor. You know, we were there for a very long time.
Right. And you have a lot of corporate clients, right?
Huge amount of corporate clients.
So, right, because so many of our listeners are employees of Fidelity or State Street, but many of them have come in for actual improv training. Can you explain that?
Yeah, absolutely. So a huge part of what we do falls under our team building / corporate training division. Fidelity is a very large client of ours. We just did something very large with Ocean Spray. Done work with Pfizer, a lot of work in the biopharma area. Companies come to us, falls in that team building, learning category, and we need breakout rooms. And so finally to have a facility that the client can come right in here and do this, it's wonderful. It's right here in Faneuil Hall. The other thing, it saves them thousands and thousands of dollars, right? Because typically they'd have to hire us. They'd have to find a place to have 3 breakout rooms, 4 breakout rooms. So it's really great in that aspect of it. And again, the idea, right, is the traditional office and retail space is not coming back. It's not coming back, right? So what do you do with all this? And traditionally, in the arts, rehearsal spaces are, typically speaking, way out in neighborhoods that are not accessible very well by T. They're not known. How do you get there? My concept is, well, what if you flip that? What if you put that in a place like Faneuil Hall, where everybody knows, everybody feels comfortable? This is how you can get here. Also, It's spaces like this, and it's the arts and the business of arts. I'm not talking about the soft end of, isn't it great for culture? I'm talking about the business of arts, right? That's what's going to be your driver. Because you know where all of our students, what they do after class when they leave here?
They go to a bar.
Yes, they do, right? They go to a bar. They go to the sandwich shop. When our corporate clients come in here, they need lunch. They need catering. They need all of those things. It's the same thing with our theaters or our venues. You have 200 people at Improv Asylum. Some very large percentage of them go out to dinner before or after. We have a 10 o'clock show. There's 200 people waiting to go to that show, dinner before or after. Right. It's a rethinking of these retail spaces, and I'm a firm believer that the arts are going to be the driver of it. Then you flip it on the other side for the artists. They can't get spaces like this.
So you're saying this space is a boost to the Quincy Market, Faneuil Hall neighborhood, which does have some vacant retail right now.
Some vacant retail. They have tons of vacant retail, right? Yeah. It's a huge boost.
As I'm speaking with Lavalette, an actor walks out of the far back room where casting director Melissa Paradise set up an audition area with professional lighting and a camera.
Today I was putting some people down on tape just for some different things that they're auditioning for.
Talk about this space. Where did you used to do this, and how has this space helped your business?
I had a little office space down in Quincy, and when Norm approached me about having this option, I was like, oh, that sounds 1,000 times better for what I do and for what I need to do, and it's easier for actors to get here.
Do you come here regularly? Do you rent a space every day? Is it
a monthly subscription? I pay a certain amount every month to have access.
From a creative standpoint, what happens when you have comedians and dancers and singers and podcasters and casting agents all under the same roof? Well, they start talking and they start collaborating. And that's from an artistic standpoint what I'm going for.
And again, that's Norm Lavalette and Melissa Paradise talking about Asylum Collab in Faneuil Hall. This is, you know, first and foremost a business that he's running, and he's very clear that the arts don't need to be viewed as a charity case, but that this, you know, by the city or anyone else. And in case you're wondering about the numbers, an individual membership is about $99 a month, nonprofit membership $299 a month. Arts groups, things like that, and that includes 8 hours of private meeting and rehearsal space, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so where are, I mean, when I understand the corporate side, the corporate clients, and in terms of those breakouts that he was talking about, but where are the younger people coming from? Where are these students coming from?
Well, the students are basically anyone in the Boston area who wants to take improv classes. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people do it at night. I actually know a number of people who've taken classes either at Improv Asylum or Improv Boston. Those are two different organizations. But it's just a fun way to meet other people. It's like taking an art class or taking a writing class in Boston. And they do evening classes. I mean, I'm sure there are classes daytime, too. But they can be people of all ages.
You know, and this guy's very passionate, very excited
yeah.
about this.
Mm-hmm.
And that
yeah,
was
very much.
That's fun to see. And the idea that, you know, these folks that are going to use this space are going to eat sandwiches and go and get drinks at the bar. That's absolutely true. You know, this is primo retail space, or it was in Boston. And I'm just thinking there's no way that this will drive the kind of traffic that a more robust retail area would have drawn, right? I mean, I guess.
Well,
here's
the thing, Tom. If you go into the Gap or Banana Republic, there's yeah. nobody in there right
no,
now.
No, I understand. And I understand.
There are way more people looking at or wandering right. in and out of this co-working
so
space.
So you got to do something. But what I'm getting at is, is it ever going to reach the level it once was? I don't know.
You're wondering just in general about Quincy Market, Faneuil Hall area?
Yeah, really. I mean, I know he's making lemonade out of lemons, I think, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
All the more power to him, but it's not going to be quite the same.
No, I mean, he's not going to be able to revive retail in that area, and that's certainly not
no.
his goal.
Right.
And I mean, I think it all depends too on the time of year. There are tourists always flocking to that area, no mm-hmm. matter what the time of year was. But it still feels somewhat empty. Yeah. So mm-hmm. I mean, it's also a matter of the property owners, and it's not just Gazette; it's another property owner on the other side reviving and refreshing that area.
We're going to spend the next few minutes talking about credit unions versus banks. In particular, we're going to be focusing on Digital Federal Credit Union. It's a credit union. It's based in Marlborough, Massachusetts. It has over 1 million members. It is the largest credit union headquartered in New England as measured by assets, managing over $10 billion. DCU, as it's known, has 19 full-service branches in Massachusetts and 4 full-service branches in New Hampshire, although it has members in all 50 states. Well, this past August, they picked a new CEO and president. She is Shruti Miyashiro, and she joins us now. Shruti, welcome to the program. Thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on this new position, and I understand welcome back to Massachusetts. Now, we understand, obviously, that we know that banks are for profit. Credit unions are not for profit. Nonetheless, talk to us about the business of a credit union and, you know, why I would do business with a credit union as opposed to a traditional bank.
Yeah, great question that's often asked. The beauty of credit unions, which were founded in America right after the Great Depression, at a time when banking services were very limited and people could not find safe places to save their money or places to borrow from. That was the start of credit unions, the cooperative movement. And so to this day, credit unions remain this wonderful intersection of complex, innovative, very forward-looking traditional banking services, but at the same time, very values-driven. So the definition of success at a credit union is always centered around the person, the customer. And we're able to do very innovative things. At DCU, for example, we provide paychecks 2 days earlier than they're normally posted in other places, completely free checking. We know there are problems in society with savings rates for a lot of folks. So we have a savings account with the first $1,000 at 6.17% interest. Yeah. We also offer mortgages and other things. So it's quite interesting.
It is, and it sounds a lot of that sounds like what a bank does, Shruti. What are the advantages over a bank?
Well, you still get the great financial services, digital products, digital delivery, all of that, mortgages, et cetera. What you get, though, is a focus on the definition of success. When our board of directors sits in a board meeting monthly, they're focused on the impact to the individual member or customer, as banks would call them. They're focused not on the profits as a bottom line or stock prices, and focused completely on how we're helping individuals, families, and communities as our definition of success.
Shruti Miyashiro is our guest. She is the president, the new president and CEO of Digital Federal Credit Union, put in a position, I guess, last August, so not that new. But nonetheless, I'm curious as to what are the biggest challenges you face. Sounds like, credit unions, I assume you have competition just within your own credit union network there. But, I mean, what are the biggest challenges as you sit down in this new position as president and CEO?
It's helping people understand the value of a credit union. The difference for us is how we are able to help people, as you said, your father, a member of St. Mary's Bank. And so a lot of folks stay with traditional financial institutions where the fees are high or the rates are not as advantageous to them. And so making the switch is always hard. People think it's a lot of work to make the switch to a different financial institution, but we've got systems in place to make it much easier, especially at times of an impending recession. We're finding that there are so many ways we customize our products to meet the needs of our members that they're truly helped by being able to join a credit union, any credit union.
Yeah. Shruti, you know, I can remember back when it was Digital Credit Union in Maynard, and yes. Because it came out of, you know, Digital, Ken Olson's computer company. But, you know, it's really grown since then. Now, obviously, you weren't there back then, but take us through that a bit. Since those days in Maynard, now you're based in Marlboro. Talk about locations and how many, you know, just how many people you serve.
Yeah, our roots are incredible. I'm so glad you brought up Digital Equipment Corporation. We were founded in the late 70s by some employees, brilliant folks at what was then called DEC, who wanted a place, again, to collaborate, build a cooperative financial institution. And as you may know, this was a brand that was well-known in Massachusetts. They actually created the miracle mile, so to speak, in Massachusetts in terms of bringing all these fintech, these tech companies here to Massachusetts. So from there, we're throughout the state of Massachusetts. We've grown, as you mentioned, to $10 billion plus in assets, 1 million members across the nation. 50% of our members are here in New England. The other 50% are across the nation, everywhere. So it's amazing what the founders of digital credit union way back in the day in the late 70s, probably couldn't have imagined how large this would have grown. Yeah. A top 20 in the nation today.
How does a slowing economy, the possibility of a recession, impact you and what you do as president and CEO there?
It is impacting potentially a lot of financial institutions. Prior to my arrival, full credit to our board and management who was here before I even arrived. We have solid liquidity, very good quality lending here, and we've also planned ahead in terms of how our products and services can be shaped to help members who are probably going to be suffering with either unemployment or the continued cost of inflation and affecting their buying power. So we're sitting in a better position than most because we've continued to be able to lend mortgages and we've continued to have a lot of liquidity and strong capital here. So we're very fortunate.
Shruti Miyashiro is with us. She is the president and CEO of the Digital Federal Credit Union. But Shruti, you must see parts of your business that are weaker because of current conditions. Please talk about that a little bit.
Sure. We're seeing people more cautious about buying auto loans. Hmm. The cost of auto loans increased exponentially, especially during the pandemic when there were supply chain problems. And as a result, auto sales have started to decline across the nation relatively over the last few years. We're also seeing, because of higher rates, people are not refinancing mortgages. Hmm. They are purchasing homes, but with the higher interest rates that are out there right now, people are cautious about that as well. And we have seen from a high of savings rate during COVID when people weren't spending, but there were stimulus checks coming in, we're seeing saving rates per person start to decline just as the rest of America is.
Have you had to lay people off?
Oh, no, not at all. We try very hard to avoid layoffs.
Mm-hmm. Who do you consider your competition, traditional banks or other credit unions?
Actually, neither. We see the whole spectrum of competition coming from the fact that there are, quote unquote, pinhole leaks where people are picking more than banks and credit unions for products and services. So we have a lot of fintechs who are not always regulated, but folks are now saving money there, borrowing from those institutions. So the definition of where people bank has shifted considerably from traditional banks and credit unions alone. And we're seeing that spectrum open up very much to institutions that are not insured, where money isn't protected, but nonetheless they provide convenience as a factor.
Shruti, I'm guessing at this about perceptions or misperceptions that when I hear the word credit union, and again, this is, I'm just putting it out there for your reaction, that people think maybe, well, my money's not as safe as it would be in a bank.
Right, right. That is, you're absolutely right. That's a common misperception. But credit unions have regulators just as banks do, the National Credit Union Administration. And that administration has the exact same limits of insurance as do banks. So there's actually no difference. Credit unions are very highly capitalized. And so the industry as a whole is very safe, but the insurance for customers or members remains the same as it would for traditional banks.
And it's all all their savings and their money is all backed up federally.
Absolutely, yeah. Federally.
Mm-hmm. And you need all 19 branches, Shruti, or are you thinking about reducing your footprint?
Our footprint's really strong. We actually have really great penetration in the areas where our branches are at. Again, we're very thoughtful about our business model. So what we like to have is a sustainable business model that continues to grow and not ride the roller coaster of hiring a lot of people, opening a lot of branches, and then closing branches and laying off people. Mm-hmm. That doesn't build customer confidence, and it doesn't build employee confidence.
Listen, in a few hours, Governor Charlie Baker, Putnam CEO Bob Reynolds, they're going to be honored by the Ireland Funds in a ballroom of prominent business leaders, some of them we know. Our Janet Wu spoke with one of those guys.
Yeah, the business leaders are too many to name. Bank of America CEO Brian Moynihan, Boston Scientific CEO Mike Mahoney, Fidelity Investing legend Peter Lynch, Roger Crandall, CEO of Mass Mutual. These are just a few of the members of tonight's gala committee. This afternoon, I sat down with Putnam CEO Bob Reynolds to talk about the current investing landscape, but we begin with the significance of this award.
The Ireland Fund has been special to me for a long time. Since my first days in Boston, got invited to Ireland Fund's dinner in the mid-80s. Since then, have been very involved, certainly the charitable work it does in both the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, but also its work in local communities. I know all the people that have gone through and have contributed significantly, so it means a lot.
And a lot of prominent executives like yourself will be there tonight. This marks your 14th year as CEO of Putnam. What are the most significant changes you've seen in investing during that time?
Right when I first got here, what happened in 2008, the huge market downturn really changed the market, the way funds are distributed, money flows, et cetera, because the number of assets, number of companies that were driving the market was a much smaller number. Obviously, indexing really took off during that period. It's been a very interesting time. You know, every day that goes by gets more interesting.
Well, definitely we are in a time of high anxiety for investors, especially those closer to retirement. What are you seeing?
Well, I think we're seeing the right moves. I mean, people in 401ks, obviously, as they come up the age curve, their investments get more conservative. We definitely see that happening. The use of fixed income and move to less risky assets is definitely taking place. On the equity side, we see equity flows, a lot of equity flows on the more defensive stocks, the yield stocks, value stocks, et cetera.
We are speaking with Bob Reynolds, president and CEO of Putnam Investments, which manages about $170 billion. Bob, speaking of 401ks, you are credited with shaping modern retirement investing with 401ks. You wrote a book about it. Anything you wish would be different with those vehicles?
Yeah, I think there are several proposals in Washington to enhance them even more than they are today, and that means automatic enrollment. In other words, everyone enrolls automatically unless they decide not to. Automatic escalation, where over a period of time your contributions increase. Really, it's to get people participating, number one, but also participating at a higher level. All those are very, very positive. And then you've seen the advent of plans that allow companies that don't necessarily set up the plan themselves, but their participants can participate in a multi-employer plan, and I think they have a great future.
Bob, of course, you are in the business, but it is still surprising how many Americans do not participate.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to, one, the companies have to provide them, and if the companies don't, we have to make it easier for people to participate. There are ways we can make the system more attractive, and there's two bills in Congress right now that have a chance.
We are speaking with Bob Reynolds, president and CEO of Putnam Investments. Just last week, Fidelity, where you spent a number of years prior to Putnam, you served as chief operating officer, announced plans to convert six mutual funds into active ETFs. Are you making or planning similar conversions at Putnam?
We are not. In our case, we would rather provide people choice. In other words, if we have a strategy that is working very well or a fund doing very well, we would offer that as an active ETF also. And that way, we're not deciding the vehicle the individual chooses to invest. That's our philosophy as we head down the path of active ETFs.
Speaking to that, Bob, Putnam bills itself as an active manager. What are your thoughts on the debate between active versus passive management?
Well, I definitely think there's room for both. Index funds have been around for 50, 60 years, so it's not a new thing, but there are periods in the market, and then you can go over time where active dramatically outperforms passive, and when I mentioned a few stocks were driving the market, passive can outperform a diversified fund. So a lot depends upon market conditions, but I do think there's room for both in today's investment world.
Putnam actually precedes those active managed funds because as an 85-year-old investment house, you need to keep innovating to stay relevant. What are the challenges and changes you see on the horizon?
Yeah, I think if you don't come to work every day thinking, how can I improve the business, you'll probably be stagnant or out of business 2 years from now. every day is a chance for improvement, and that's what we try to do. And whether it be type of funds, and we've rolled out several new funds recently, whether it be structure, you mentioned active ETFs, we do separately managed accounts, and we have different flavors of active ETFs. And I think it's across the board. It's just constantly looking at what is the need of the marketplace and try to be ahead of it.
Speaking about types of funds, I want to ask you about ESG. I have interviewed Catherine Collins, your head of sustainable investing, and just last month, ESG portfolio manager Stephanie Dobson. Putnam converted a pair of growth funds into ESG funds several years ago. Is this also a trend you expect to strengthen?
Yes. ESG, unfortunately, I would say over the last 18 months has become somewhat political, and it really shouldn't be political. It should be on the investment merit, and companies that are doing the right thing generally are rewarded. We think the opportunity for ESG is enormous as we look out over the next 5-10 years, and the U.S. is slightly behind other parts of the world, but we will definitely get there.
We are speaking with Bob Reynolds, President and CEO of Putnam Investments, which manages about $170 billion. Bob, tell us about your return to work situation. What percentage of your workforce is now back in the office?
Back in April, we made a decision that we would have Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday as collaboration day, meaning people in the office. And then Monday and Friday is up to the individual working with his or her manager. We have found that to work very well, and we're performing at a very high level across the board.
Finally, Bob, you were instrumental in forming the Putnam Club at Gillette Stadium. Much nicer seats, thank you. You are a big Patriots fan. Zappy or Mac?
Mac.
And on that, he was extremely decisive.
Yeah, very.
Wow,
I'll tell you, yes. He didn't hesitate.
Yes, I can tell you we had a fantastic interview. He promises to return again. They're going to be introducing new products in the new year that we are not allowed to discuss yet, but you will hear about it first on Bloomberg. And I want to let you know that all of those executives will be joined together tonight at the Westin Copley, where Bob Reynolds and Governor Baker will be honored. And I will be there.
Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention?
Lesson number one.
News flash, Big Slim.
I used to be number one in this town.
I'm Joey Tribbiani, and here are today's top stories.
All right, Dateline Doha. This comes to us courtesy of the Associated Press. This is the top story in the last hour. Kim's been talking about this. We should feast over it again. The U.S. advances in the World Cup with a 1-0 win over Iran. A lot of folks in our audience and people on the Bloomberg Terminal turned to this story. The goal winner, the only goal, one goal, Joe, Christian Pulisic, scored this while crashing headfirst into the goalkeeper in the 38th minute. This brought the victory. Now, here's what's happening. This is the first time we've been in the World Cup since 2018. We opened with draws against Wales and England. This victory was absolutely necessary to move on to the round of 16. And as Kim has been saying, we play the Netherlands on Saturday with the chance to reach the quarterfinals for the first time since 2002. So that's the top story with good reason, Joe.
There you go. Thank you very much, Tom. Okay, so we're going to close out the show today talking about, well, if you're a top salesperson, you are what? You are a rainmaker, right? Well, how do you become a rainmaker? Well, there is an app for that. Basically, it's the Rainmaker app, and if you're looking for it in the App Store, it's RNMKRS, which as my producer pointed out, which is Rainmakers without the vowels. So,
thank goodness
we have him here to point that
just
out.
Just one more reason.
I know, one more reason to keep paying the guy. Now, let's see. This is the creation of Stephanie Boyer. She is a professor at Bryant University in Rhode Island, and she joins us now to tell us all about it. Professor, thank you very much for joining us. So as I understand it, this app, your students are talking to a bot, an artificial intelligence-infused bot that reacts to their conversation?
That is exactly right, and thank you so much for having me. I love the work that you're doing. That is absolutely right. And it's not just me. I work together with a team of people, of engineers, students, faculties, and employers to all really design this tool. that helps train people how to have these conversations.
All right. So, Stephanie, does it work? And if it does, how do we know that?
That's a really good question. Well, the bot has had a lot of conversations. We've had over 20,000 students running through the program, and they've come from community colleges. They've come from universities at the undergraduate level and even at the graduate level. Even Harvard in the graduate classes are using this. And those students that have experience, you know, they will chew you up and spit you out if you don't have a technology that works.
Wow. Okay. We're talking with Professor Stephanie Boyer. There she is at Bryant University in Rhode Island. Okay. So come on, Stephanie. Now, if we're selling and we're selling in the real world, we're talking to real people. We're not talking to computers or bots. So how is this helping to train the next generation of salespeople?
Sure. Well, first, we start out by showing them some videos about how to sell. And then we ask them some questions. So we quiz them along the way. And then they get to actually apply and practice the things that they learned. You can't just teach people how to sell by telling them what to do. You have to put them in a situation that's going to train them how to do that. And luckily, there's decades of experienced researchers out there trying to find out what really works and what does not work. Because, you know, going out to a sale is just it's devastating when it doesn't go your way. So we've taken that sales process and we've trained our bots through many algorithms to have these conversations. So in about a third of a second, the student or the trainee is talking to the bot. In a third of a second, it's processing what's being said. It's thinking about what it wants to say back, and then it's actually giving feedback at the end when the student's finished. So the idea is doing lots of practice, doing these role plays, being able to sell in a way that helps people.
All right. So if I'm terrible at what I'm doing, what does the bot say to me if I've
says you're terrible?
It says you're terrible. If I am not getting it done, what does the bot do to me?
Well, you know what? The bot is adaptive. So it's kind of like the Olympics, right? If you go in and you try something that's really difficult, it's going to give you a higher score. And if you go out and you try something that's not quite as hard, it's going to give you a lower score. But then the bot also helps to coach along, right? So if you're starting the conversation and, you know, you don't have an agenda in place or you're not building rapport, you're not starting to ask questions, the bot will say something like, hey, well, you know, did you have some questions that you wanted to ask me today? Or why don't you tell me a little bit about your product? So the bot will actually coach them if they're not
doing
well.
So it's a coach. So in other words, give us an example of a conversation. So in other words, the student says, now I can put you in a Mercedes today. And what does the bot say? So I'm the bot. I don't have the money. What would the student say to that? I don't mean to misrepresent your app. Does the bot sound like that?
No, the bot sounds like a person. The bot actually sounds like a person with a little bit of a southern accent.
Why is that?
A little bit of one. Well, because the bot is actually someone who lives in Texas. It's either a IT manager at a police station or at a fire station, for the students that are competing in the competition.
So they're presented with what amounts, you know, this is as real a person as you can get. Then this is, they have an identity and everything else?
They do. They have a background. They even have a LinkedIn page and everything.
Okay.
Talk to us about downloads of this Rainmakers app, RNMKRS. How are you doing? How many people are using this on a daily basis?
Well, we're getting about 3,000 students each semester that are participating, and we've had over 20,000 students that have gone through the program. And, you know, every single day we're inching towards 1 million conversations.
Does the bot get better? I mean, hopefully the kids will get better.
Yes. You know, that is an excellent question. With every single conversation that happens, it gets better and better each time.
Well, that means it's harder for the next kid coming along.
Well, what
we're doing is we're learning how people are talking. We learn so many different ways that people say things. that people introduce themselves, that people ask questions. And so we're learning with every single conversation.
You know, Stephanie Boyer is with us. This app is Rainmaker without the vowels, as our producer points out. You know, when I thought about what you're doing, I thought, you know, there are some people who believe either you're born with it or you're not. And what I'm thinking about is Professor Harold Hill in The Music Man, the greatest salesman ever, played by Robert Preston, not by those other people. Robert Preston. I mean, why don't you just have him watch The Music Man?
Well, like I said before, you cannot get good at having conversations and selling by watching. You have to engage.
You have to
actively participate. Okay. You have to make mistakes. You have to learn how it feels to say things a certain way.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, it costs money, a good amount of money, to get where you are today with this Rainmakers app. Talk to us about the dollars involved, the investors involved.
Well, right now, we've just basically bootstrapped this. When we were first coming out with it, I was struggling. I was giving my students role plays. I had 70 role plays to watch every single week. I just couldn't do it. So I met Scott Randall, who's my business partner, and he had a tool he was creating, an interpersonal communication engine. And we decided we would work this around sales conversations to have the biggest impact. And we actually approached Dell. And we created this minimum viable product, which is a pizza practice. You go into a pizza shop and you're helping someone who's coming into a pizza shop to figure out what they want to eat. And they have problems. They have gluten allergies. They have all kinds of issues. And you have to be able to adapt. So we created this minimum viable product. And we brought it to Dell, one of the VPs at the time, Steve Sadler. And we asked him if he would be open to exploring this, to be able to give education for free to college students. And so he was on board. He was on board with it. And they helped pay for this project. And we brought in some other companies as well. And so the companies pay to get access to these students, to get access to see how much grit they have, looking at their performance, getting access to them in meetings. And then that actually pays for our engineers and how we run this program.
You know, we do a fair amount of talking to people who have apps. And I got to tell you, it sounds like I can recognize a built-in audience already, not just on the student level, the academic level, but you could have companies interested in saying, you know, let's use this with folks who already work here.
Exactly. You know, and we've started working on some of these products outside of what we're doing. We've created some customer service products. We've been working closely with Dell and some of our companies, and that's really the next step is people are saying, wow, these students did 100, 150 role plays this semester. They're really ready, or they're running circles around our other employees that haven't had so much coaching. How do we get everybody else up to speed? And so that's really the next step.
All right. She's Stephanie Boyer, and she's a professor at Bryant University. Thank you for sharing with us the Rainmakers app. But tomorrow, well, the Prince and Princess of Wales are in town, and we, of course, will be covering that. Join us at 2 o'clock on Bloomberg Bay State Business. We're here tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.